Well, turn with me, please, to the passage that we read as we continue our studies in the book of Romans. I'm looking at this passage from chapter 9, verse 24, to chapter 10, verse 4. Now, I recently read the autobiography of Professor F.F. Bruce. Bruce was a Scotsman who was brought up in the Brethren Church and who in the mid-20th century became an outstanding New Testament scholar. He rose to a very prominent position in the University of Manchester and generally did much to gain credibility for evangelical scholarship within the academic world. And in his autobiography, he speaks of how, having graduated from Cambridge in the mid-1930s, he then went out to Vienna to engage in some postgraduate study there. And while in Vienna, he took the opportunity to do a bit of travelling around Europe. And one of the things that was particularly memorable to him about his European travels was how he enjoyed fellowship with Christians in so many of the places that he visited. And he recalls being in a Christian gathering on one occasion in Hungary and being in conversation with a gentleman at this gathering. And he happened to remark to this chap that the next place that he intended to visit was Bratislava in Slovakia. And to that he received the response that we always find it very odd that Slovaks can also be believers, because we have always thought of them as our enemies. We always find it odd that Slovaks can also be believers. We've always thought of them as our enemies. Now that Hungarian Christian to whom F.F. Bruce was speaking was touching there on a recurring issue within the Christian church. We live in a world, and the Christian church has always operated in a world in which ethnic distinctions are very pronounced and are taken very seriously. And because the church has to operate in that kind of a world, the church, particularly in its missionary endeavors, has to be constantly examining this whole issue of the relationship between ethnic identity and the Christian gospel. And this was something which the Apostle Paul, as one of the church's first missionaries, also had to examine. He had to examine this relationship between ethnic identity and the Christian gospel. Now, for him, of course, in his day, it didn't have anything to do with Hungarians and Slovaks. For him in his day, it had to do with Jews and Gentiles. And this was a particularly difficult one, a particularly complex one to have to think through because of the Old Testament background in which, of course, the Jews were in covenant with God and the Gentiles weren't. This was a real minefield for the church in the first century AD. You don't have to read much of the New Testament to realize that. And some real apostolic clarity, therefore, was required on this whole matter of how do we relate ethnic identity to the Christian gospel? What's the relationship between the two things? What bearing does the one have on the other? Some apostolic clarity was required. And as we've hinted at before, throughout this epistle to the Romans, Paul deals with this matter, but particularly in chapters 9 to 11. That really is the focus of this section of the letter, the relationship between these racial and ethnic identities and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And last time, 2 weeks ago, we saw that Paul's starting point in chapters 9 to 11 is the present spiritual plight of the Jews. And when I say present, I mean present when Paul was writing. In verse 3 of chapter 9, he describes the Jews in his own day, or at least he does so implicitly. He describes them as cursed and as cut off from Christ. This was the state of the Jews, as Paul was writing. They were cursed, he says, and cut off from Christ. Of course, he's not talking about every single Jew of his day. Paul himself was a Jew. Peter was a Jew. James was a Jew. John was a Jew, and so on. But he's saying that on the whole, this was the situation. Now, Paul wasn't recording this in some clinical fashion as a mere fact that he had observed. This was something, as we saw last time, that was tearing Paul to pieces. It was breaking the apostle's heart to witness. I am in great sorrow and unceasing anguish, he says in verse 2. It was something that really, really troubled him. And so we looked then last time at those first few verses under the heading, A Grieving Apostle. But then in verse 6 to verse 23 of chapter 9, Paul goes on to consider three possible objections. Objection number one, if this is really true, if this really is the spiritual state of the Jews today, if they really are cursed and cut off from Christ, then doesn't that pose serious questions over God's integrity? Because throughout the Old Testament, God had made many promises. Promises of astonishing and wonderful blessing to Israel, to the Jews. Well, if the Jews, if Israel now in Paul's day are nowhere spiritually, then what has happened to all those promises that God had made concerning them? And Paul answers that objection. He says, there are two Israels. There are two Israels. There are those Israelites that are Israelites purely ethnically and racially. They're Israelites purely in their blood, if you like. But then within that number, there are those other Israelites who, like the first Israel, like the patriarch who had that name, Jacob, like him, despite being no better and no worthier and no more deserving than anybody else, they have experienced the intimate touch of God upon their lives. And it was to those Israelites, those second type of Israelites, it was to those that God made all those promises in the Old Testament. And to those Israelites, the promises have come true. They have come good. They have been fulfilled. Second objection, that's not fair. Surely it's not fair for God to discriminate in this way and to intimately touch the lives only of certain people, not because they're any better or any worthier or any more deserving than anybody else, but simply on the basis of some sovereign, unchallengeable decision that he himself has made. That's not just. God can't do that, surely. It's unjust for him to discriminate like that between people whose lives, whose worthiness is equal. Well, Paul's answer to that is, no, it's not a matter of justice. If God was obliged to bless, to lavish blessing upon all men, if God was obliged to do that, then it would be a matter of justice. Then he would be unjust to discriminate between this person and that person, to bless this one and not that one. Then he would be unjust. But God isn't obliged. God isn't obliged to bless anybody. Because we're all sinners, we've all rejected him, and we all deserve, therefore, the very worst from him. We all deserve only to be hardened by him, as Pharaoh famously was. We all deserve only to be given by God a disposition to hate him and reject him more and more and more, and so store up more and more wrath for ourselves on the day of judgment. That's all we deserve. And if God then should decide, instead of doing that, to bless some people, he's not unjust in doing so. Not unjust at all. Third objection. How then can God ever blame those whom he hasn't chosen? How can there be a day of judgment? How can those who haven't had intimate relations with God in this life be liable for that if ultimately the whole thing lay not in their control but in his? How can he blame anybody? And Paul's answer to that is, it's about time you stopped objecting and recognized your station, that you're just a humble creature who has no more right to interrogate the Creator than a clay pot has to interrogate the potter. And so we looked last time then at those three objections and their answers under our second heading that morning, a theological defense. But unfortunately at that point, once again, we suffered defeat at the hands of the clock and we had to go home with unfinished business. And we didn't come to our third heading, which was going to be a gospel implication in verse 24 down to verse 29. Because so far in this chapter, Paul's presentation of this truth that God intimately touches the lives of certain people, and it's entirely of his initiative, and it's entirely his decision, and it's not based at all on any credentials that they might have. Paul's presentation of this truth has been quite negative, hasn't it? It's been in a negative sense that he's been setting this forth. He's been saying, basically, that not all Israelites, ethnically, are true Israelites. Not all those who are descended from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, not all of them are the true Israel, the real Israel, the Israel that really matters. And so he's been, as I say, presenting this truth in a quite a negative way. He's saying that the real Israel is smaller and narrower and more limited than you've ever thought that it was. But here now in verse 24 to 29, the emphasis changes and he brings out a gospel implication, a good news implication of this truth of divine election. Namely this, that because of election, you can find God's people in the most unlikely situations. Because of election, you can find God's people in the most unlikely situations. And in these verses, Paul focuses on two unlikely situations, two situations in which you would be most unlikely on the face of things to come across any of God's people. First of all, amongst the Gentiles. Amongst the Gentiles. Think about it. Think about this city of Rome to which this letter that Paul was writing was heading. A Gentile city. A city in which the majority of the population were Gentiles. A city in which the majority of the population, therefore, couldn't claim any of those privileges that Paul lists in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 9. A city in which the majority of the population couldn't claim a national spiritual heritage reaching all the way back to Abraham. Now, you would have thought, therefore, on the face of things, that the chances of there being Roman men and women numbered amongst the people of God were really very slim. Very unlikely that in Rome, amongst the Roman people, these Gentile people, you would find any of God's people. But you see, Paul wants us to understand in this passage that if everything depends ultimately on God's sovereign decision and on God's sovereign call, then that kind of thinking doesn't apply. Yes, these Romans, they might seem the wrong kind of people to be amongst God's people. They might not tick the right boxes. They might not have the right background, the right heritage, the right history, the right blood. They might not have the right descendants. But if everything depends upon God's sovereign decision and God's sovereign call, none of that matters. In the light of election, then, yes, even amongst the Gentiles, there can be those who are God's people. And so Paul says in verse 23, what if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory, even us? He's writing to these Roman believers, whom he also called not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles, as he says in Hosea, and he backs it up then with these two quotations from Hosea, both of which originally were spoken to Israel, but like so many Old Testament prophecies, are applied by New Testament writers to the Christian church. And so, do you see what he's saying then? That if being in the people of God doesn't ultimately depend on our ethnicity, on our background, on our blood, on our gene pool, if it depends upon rather God's sovereign initiative, God's decision, God's call, then even amongst the Gentiles, there can be those who are numbered amongst God's people. And of course, we can extend it beyond Rome. What about Newcastle? Again, a predominantly Gentile city. A city where, on the face of things, it's so unlikely that there would be anybody numbered amongst the people of God. A city, the majority of the population of which can't claim the privileges listed in verses 4 and 5. And yet here we are today, Gentiles mainly, I'm sure, worshipping God. How? We don't tick the right boxes. We're not the right kind of people, surely. We're not likely candidates to be worshippers of God. We're Gentiles. But because of this truth of election, God's decision, God's call, God's initiative. You have it brought out very strikingly, don't you, in that passage in Acts 18. Remember how Paul is in the city of Corinth. And I suppose that if any people were unlikely on the face of things to be numbered amongst the people of God, more than the people of Rome, more than the people of Newcastle, it would be the people of Corinth. That wasn't only a Gentile city, but it represented the very worst of Gentile hedonism and immorality and godlessness. And it seems that even Paul himself, seeking to evangelize in that city, began to lose heart. And there in Acts 18, he's most dispirited by all the persecution and all the abuse that he's facing. But remember what happens. The Lord appears to him in a vision in the night. And he tells Paul to keep on going, not to be silent, but to keep on witnessing, keep on evangelizing. Why? Because he says, I have many people in this city. Why was Paul to keep on evangelizing in Corinth? Because the Corinthians were likely candidates to become Christians. Of course they were, not a bit of it. They were the most unlikely candidates to become Christians. But because of God's election, because God had chosen unlikely Corinthians to be amongst his people. Let's thank God this morning for this wonderful doctrine of election. On account of it, you and I, as Gentiles, as the most unlikely candidates to be in the people of God, are in the people of God this morning. And because of it, we can go and evangelize to other Gentiles with great confidence that amongst them too, they will prove to be the people of God. So that's one unlikely situation then, amongst the Gentiles. The other unlikely situation that Paul mentions, the other situation where you wouldn't think you would find any of God's people, was in the Israel of Isaiah's day. The Israel of Isaiah's day. Because in verse 27 to 29, he has these two quotations from Isaiah. Now, Isaiah prophesied in very dark days in the people of Israel. Days of great covenant disloyalty, days of great sin and rebellion. Of course, we tend to focus on the glorious prophecies that Isaiah made as he looked into the distant future, and they are wonderful. But at the same time, much of Isaiah is taken up with grave threats as Isaiah looked at the Israel of his day. And yet, in the midst of those grave threats, in the midst of what Isaiah says about the Israel of his day, there's another tone as well. There's another note. And it's this reference to the remnant. Paul quotes from Isaiah in verse 27. Though the number of the Israelites be like the sand by the sea, only the remnant will be saved. Or then in the other quotation, it's not the word remnant, but this word descendants kind of fulfills the same purpose. Unless the Lord Almighty had left us descendants, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah. Now, you would have thought, when you read Isaiah, you read what he says about the people of his day, and you read him describing their sins and accusing them of all kinds of wickedness, you wouldn't have thought on the face of things you would find any of God's people amongst that generation of Israelites. And yet Paul is reminding us there was a remnant, there were descendants, there were some. Why? Because of this doctrine of election. And again, we could extend it beyond the Israel of Isaiah's day. In fact, you could apply it to the Israel of virtually any day in the Old Testament. You think of one striking example that always amazes me when I read it, in the book of Ruth, and that man Boaz. Remember, the book of Ruth was written, the events that took place were at the time of the judges. And that period in Israel's history was so terribly, terribly dark. Israel was so wayward. Those days when there was no king and every man did what he saw fit. And yet there in the midst of all that spiritual dearth and darkness, there was that man Boaz. A man who was so godly. A man who was so righteous. Who was so kind and gracious and considerate. A man who was careful in his obedience to the law. How come? How come there could be any Boazes in such days? How come the tide of evil hadn't swept over every single person without exception? Because of this truth of election. And so, we should thank God again then this morning for this doctrine of election that throughout the history of the church, even in its very darkest days in the Old Testament, there were never no believers. There were never no faithful men and women. There were never no covenant keepers because of this doctrine of election. It means that you can find God's people in the most unlikely situations. And so that brings us then to the end of verse 29 in Romans chapter 9. And in the kind of new section that begins then in verse 30, Paul returns to the theme that he'd begun at the start of the chapter. He returns to this matter that is his primary focus just now of the spiritual plight of the Jews. And really from chapter 9 verse 30 to the end of chapter 10, chapter 10 verse 21, Paul explores the reasons for this spiritual plight amongst the Jews in his own day. Now you might be sitting there thinking, well, that's obvious. We know in the light of what Paul has already written in Romans 9, we know what the reason was for the spiritual plight of the Jews in his own day. It was simply that they weren't elect. If God operates on the basis of election, then the reason surely for the spiritual plight of the Jews, as for the spiritual plight of anyone you might care to consider, the reason was that they weren't elect. They weren't part of God's chosen people. Full stop. End of story. No more explanation required. But that's not what Paul says. If you read this passage, he doesn't mention election. Well, is Paul contradicting himself then? Is he contradicting what he has said earlier on? Has he gone back on this truth of election? Well, no, of course he hasn't. But Paul is saying, you see, that yes, election is one perspective from which you can view the plight of the Jews in my day. But it's not the only perspective. There's another perspective as well. And yes, it might be that our feeble, finite minds struggle to work out how there can be two perspectives and how they can possibly fit together without contradicting each other. But it's simply the case, and it's something that we've simply got to accept and believe. And what's this other perspective then? Well, the other perspective is that Israel herself has created her own spiritual mess. The Jews have created their own spiritual plight. Now, as I say, that seems to us irreconcilable with this other truth that we've been considering of God's sovereign election. Well, the Bible doesn't ask us to reconcile these two perspectives, but it asks us and tells us to believe them both. And so, in just a few minutes then, and I'm determined that the clock's not going to beat us this morning, let's just look at this under three quick headings. Israel having created her own mess. First of all, a misplaced zeal. A misplaced zeal. Look at verse 2 of chapter 10. Paul talking about the Jews then. And he says, I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. So he's saying that these Jews of his own day, he's saying that they were zealous. They weren't apathetic. They weren't religious couch potatoes. Theirs wasn't an armchair kind of religion. There was an energy. There was a passion. There was a vigor. There was a zeal about their religion. And not only is that, but he says that they were zealous for God. So the religion of these Jews of his own day, it wasn't an idolatrous religion. It wasn't a polytheistic religion. They weren't like their distant forefathers in the days before the exile who had bowed down to all the Canaanite gods and that kind of thing. No, the Jews of Paul's day, they were zealous for the one true and living God, the God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament. They had a zeal, and it was a zeal for God. But, he says, that zeal was not based on knowledge. So he's saying that the Jews of his own day, they wanted to be right with God. They wanted to please God. They wanted to be close to God. They wanted to be on good terms with God. But the way in which they directed that desire was, Paul says, ignorant. It lacked knowledge. Imagine that a man falls in love with a woman and he decides after some time that he wants to buy her some amazing gift. He wants to really impress her. He wants to really please her. He wants to really endear himself to her. And this man, he's a stamp enthusiast. He collects stamps. And so he decides that he'll get for this woman a really great stamp. He'll find some really old stamp that's worth loads of money, and he'll present her with that. And so he goes to tremendous amount of effort, and he goes on the internet, spends hours looking up all these stamp dealers, and he gets on the phone and talks to loads of them. He goes to see his bank manager to make sure he can withdraw all this money that he needs to pay for this stamp, and he finds the one that he wants. It's really old, and it's worth a lot of money. It's greatly desired by lots of stamp collectors, and so he goes for it, and he gets it. And he then he's very excited about, you know, putting it in an envelope and presenting it to this woman whom he loves. And that's all very impressive, isn't it? All that energy he's unleashed on getting this gift. All the lengths he's gone to, all the money he's paid for it. But if the woman he loves has absolutely no interest whatsoever in stamps, if stamps bore her to tears, if for her the usefulness of stamps is exhausted once you've posted a letter, if she couldn't care less about stamps, she knows nothing about them, she thinks that they're stupid and a waste of time, and it's a ridiculous hobby, then she's not going to be very impressed with the gift that he has given her. And you see, here are these Jews, and they're zealous. They're zealous for God. They're going to great lengths to please Him, to endear themselves to Him, to be right with Him. But they're ignorant, just like that man didn't know what that woman really wanted. He thought she wanted stamps when she didn't want stamps at all. The Jews were just like that. They were doing what God didn't want. And we must always make sure that we don't fall into that danger. Religious zeal isn't always a good thing. Religious zeal in and of itself is useless. Religious zeal, if it's misplaced, is absolutely no value whatsoever. There are hundreds, thousands, millions of people in this world who have great zeal, a zeal that perhaps exceeds our own. And perhaps some of those people, that zeal is even for the God of the Bible. And yet it's an ignorant zeal. And we must make sure this morning then that we're not just zealous, but that our zeal is based on knowledge, that we've actually looked into what it is that God wants and requires. The second heading, the wrong righteousness. The wrong righteousness. We said then that these Jews of Paul's day, they wanted to please God. They wanted to endear themselves to Him. They wanted to be right with Him. They wanted to be on good terms with Him. In a word then, they wanted to be righteous. Remember how we've seen this word righteousness in the early part of Romans, and we spoke of it as this legal status that God confers upon men and women. It's this image of the law court, God as the judge, and men and women at the bar of His justice, and God declaring them to be right with Him. And these Jews, they wanted that. They wanted that. They wanted to be at the bar of His justice and to be declared righteous by Him. Well, what then was going wrong? If that's what they wanted, where had they gone wrong? Well, Paul says they'd gone wrong in that they were aiming for the wrong kind of righteousness. He says in verse 31 of chapter 9, Israel has pursued a law of righteousness. And he's talking here then about the Old Testament law, the law of Moses. And he's saying that Israel had attempted then to, and was attempting in his day, to gain this status from God, this status of righteousness by obeying the law. And this phrase, law of righteousness, it's an odd phrase. It's the only time it occurs. And it means, I think, that the law did indeed promise righteousness. The law always promised righteousness. It promised that if you keep Me, if you keep the law perfectly, you will indeed gain that righteous standing before God. It was a law of righteousness, a law that held out righteousness to those who would keep it. But the problem, of course, as Paul exposed so rigorously in the early chapters of the letter, is that none of us can do that. The problem isn't with the law. The law is indeed a law of righteousness. It will give us righteousness if we keep it. But the problem is we can't do that. The problem's with us, not with the law. And by works then, as he mentions in verse 32, by doing things, by doing what the law commands and not doing what the law prohibits, we, because of inherent and innate sin, we shall not ever gain that righteous standing before God. Now there's a sense in which these Jews in Paul's day, they had succeeded. They had gained a righteousness. But the problem was that it was their own righteousness and not God's. Look at what he says in verse 3. They did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own. In other words, these Israelites, they were going around saying, yes, we are righteous before God. They were declaring themselves righteous. They were declaring themselves accepted before God. They had a righteousness. They had this status of being in the right with God. But it had come from them rather than from God himself. It was the wrong righteousness. It was a righteousness that consisted of doing things, of keeping the law. And it was a righteousness, therefore, which they had conferred upon themselves, and not which God, the judge of all the earth, had done. And again, it's a danger that you and I must still be very wary of. This morning, you might be here and you might think that you're accepted with God. You've lived a decent life. You've lived a respectable life. You've lived an upstanding life. You've never done anything seriously wrong. You've been a good person. And so you're saying to yourself, I'm accepted with God. But that's your righteousness then. That's your verdict about yourself. It's your pronouncement. It's not God's. And God's pronouncement of that verdict will never ensue upon you doing things and living a good life. Your good life isn't good enough to gain the righteousness that matters. So make sure this morning that you're not pursuing the wrong righteousness, a righteousness that's about doing things, and a righteousness which you yourself have conferred. But thirdly, and finally, the heart of the problem. And the heart of the problem for these Jews of Paul's day was their attitude to Jesus Christ. The heart of the problem was their attitude to Christ, because look at what Paul says in verse 4 of chapter 10. Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. And you see, Paul is saying this law, which you Jews are seeking to obey in order to be right with God, you haven't realized what the goal, I think that's what that word end would perhaps be better translated as almost, goal. You haven't realized what the goal of that law was. The goal of that law for you as sinful people, as people who can't ever keep it properly, the goal for you was never that you might, on the basis of that law, stand righteous before God. The goal of that law, the reason God gave it to you, was that it might drive you to Christ, that it might show you just how far short of God's standards you have fallen, and it might lead you to despair in anything of yourselves, in any ability that you might have to ever keep it. And it might drive you, therefore, to Christ. He is the goal of the law, so that there might be righteousness for everyone, not who works, but everyone who believes, everyone who trusts in Christ. And so the heart of the problem was that here they were, obsessed with the law, always talking about it, always patting themselves on the back because of their keeping of it. And they've missed the very goal of that law, which was to drive them to Christ in faith. And so you have that extraordinary verse, in verse 33 of chapter 9, Paul quoting from Isaiah again, from really bringing together two passages from Isaiah. See, I lay in Zion a stone that causes men to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. And this stone, this rock, it's clear from the way Paul uses these verses, the way Peter does as well in 1 Peter 2, it's clear that it's a messianic image. It's talking about the Messiah. Isaiah was predicting the Messiah when he spoke of this stone and this rock. It's talking about Christ. And Paul is saying then, in bringing together these two quotations from Isaiah, he's saying that ultimately the destiny of all men will depend on their attitude to Christ. Those who at the last aren't saved, those who at the last are lost men and women, they will be so because they have tripped over Christ, because they've stumbled over him, because, in other words, they have rejected him, because they haven't trusted in him, because they've pursued their own righteousness and haven't clung to his. And those who at the last are saved and go to glory, they will do so because they have trusted in him. They have made him their refuge and their substitute, and have clung to him by faith. It's an extraordinary exposure of the uniqueness and the exclusiveness and the all-importance of Jesus Christ. At the end of the day, everyone's destiny will depend on their attitude to Him. Either that they've rejected Him, as these Jews were rejecting Him, and were pursuing their own righteousness, and were trying to keep the law perfectly, or they will have accepted Him and trusted in Him, and conscious of their own inability to keep the law, will have depended entirely upon Him. What are you doing this morning? Your destiny, on that day that you stand before God, your Maker, your destiny will depend upon your attitude to Jesus Christ. Either you will stumble over Him into eternal hell, or having taken refuge in Him, you will be safe in heaven forever. Make sure this morning that you're not trying to win acceptance with God through doing things, through living well, through being a good person. That is rejecting Christ. Make sure this morning that you've abandoned any good works that you could ever do and are clinging solely and entirely to Him. Amen.